You know, when we think about insurance today, home, car, life insurance, it feels pretty modern, right? Like something tied up with complex financial systems.
Yeah, definitely feels that way.
But it's fascinating when you think that the basic idea that, you know, human urge to protect ourselves and our stuff from risk, that actually goes back thousands of years.
Oh, absolutely. That need to guard against the unexpected. It's surprisingly ancient. It really is.
Okay, so let's get into this. For this deep dive, we're looking at the history of life insurance, sort of tracing its path based on our research. Our mission, really, is to explore these, well, sometimes unexpected origins and see how it all evolved into the industry we have now.
Sounds good.
So if we're talking earliest forms, this instinct for protection, where do we even start?
Well, if we journey way, way back, like over 5,000 years ago in China, we found something really practical.
5,000 years, wow.
Yeah. See, piracy was a huge risk for sea merchants back then. So what they did was they'd split their cargo across several different ships.
Oh, okay. Smart.
Right. So if one ship got hit by pirates, they didn't lose everything. It's a really clear early example of, spreading the risk distribution.
That's incredibly clever. Like you said, don't put all your eggs in one basket,
Right,
basically.
exactly.
Okay, so then Babylonia, that's almost 4,500 years ago. Sounds like things got a bit more structured there.
Yeah, they did. In Babylonia, you had the caravan trade. It relied on loans, but the deal was the loan plus interest was only repaid if the goods actually arrived safely.
Interesting.
And what's really amazing is the Code of Hammurabi. This is around 2100 BC. It actually gave legal status to this stuff.
Wait, the Code of Hammurabi, like the famous one?
The very same. It formalized what they called bottomry, that was for the ships, and respondentia for the cargo. These are basically the ancient ancestors of marine insurance contracts.
Okay.
You can already see this early idea of like insurable interest taking shape.
So it wasn't like a policy document you'd sign, but the risk agreement was built right into the loan itself.
Precisely. You had three key parts. The loan, on the ship, or the goods, the interest for the lender, and then this extra charge, a surcharge, which is basically the premium to cover potential loss.
Fine.
The ship owners were, in effect, the insured, and the lenders were the underwriters. Very early form.
Okay, so that covers the financial side of risk dealing with goods and ships. What about the more personal aspect? You know, protecting people, families, if someone died.
Right. Well, that really starts to emerge in ancient Rome. You see these burial clubs forming.
Burial clothes.
Yeah. Their main goal was to make sure members got a proper, dignified burial by covering the funeral costs. But they often did more than that.
Like what?
They'd also provide some money, some financial help to the families left behind. That's a really big step, actually. One of the earliest examples of financial protection tied specifically to, well, life and death.
A basic safety net, then, for families dealing with loss. It makes sense. That would be a really fundamental concern for people.
Absolutely.
Now, the history we looked at mentions things kind of slowed down after the Roman Empire fell. What happened there?
Yeah, after the Western Roman Empire collapsed around 476 AD, a lot of those widespread insurance-like practices did fade away for a while.
Okay.
But the basic idea, that impulse for mutual support, it didn't just disappear. You see bits of it continuing through the Middle Ages, especially within the merchant and artisan guilds.
The guilds, right.
These guilds, they provided a whole range of benefits for their members, protection against fire, flood, theft, disability, even death or imprisonment.
So they're like these multi-purpose support networks.
Pretty much.
And then later on, as trade starts picking up again.
Exactly. During the feudal period, there was less travel, less long-distance trade, so those older risk management forms weren't as common. But then, between the 14th and 16th centuries, transport and trade ramp up again, and boom, the need for more formal insurance practices starts to grow, and so does the development of them. It really seems to track with economic activity, doesn't it? The need grows as things get busier.
It does. Now, our research also pointed east to ancient India. What was happening there with risk sharing?
India is really interesting. There's mention of Yogacchema in the Rig Veda. That's going back to around 1000 BC.
Yogacchema.
Yeah, it's actually part of the name of India's modern life insurance corporation today, which is fascinating. It suggests a kind of community insurance the Aryans practice, like a collective responsibility for the community's well-being.
Was it like a formal system or?
Well, the exact details are a bit debated by historians, how formal it was, what it looked like in practice, but just having that term in such an ancient text points to this long-standing idea of communal support when things got tough.
A very early concept of a social safety net.
Totally. And similar to Rome, you see burial societies developing during the Buddhist period in India. But their goals weren't just funerals. They also helped families with things like building houses or supporting widows and kids.
So that core human need for security after a loss, it just pops up again and again across different ancient cultures.
It's a constant thread.
Okay, let's jump forward quite a bit now. The source talks about modern insurance starting in England. Why was England after 1688 so important?
Right, so post-1688 England, after the Glorious Revolution, it became this real hotbed for life insurance growth. What's kind of wild is that while it was actually illegal in many other parts of Europe, England was actively encouraging it.
Really? Illegal elsewhere?
Largely, yeah. So 17th century England really laid the groundwork for the insurance systems we kind of recognize today.
And a key spot for this was Lloyd's of London. Or, well, Lloyd's Coffee House, originally. Sounds pretty informal for such a huge institution now.
It was. Lloyd's Coffee House was just the place to be for merchants, ship owners, underwriters. It was a hub, you know, they'd meet, talk about voyages, cargo, strike deals. It's basically where organized marine insurance got its start.
But the history also mentioned a less savory side to early life insurance in England. Something about gambling?
Ah, yes. This is where it gets. Yeah. Well, interesting and a bit dark. Life insurance, which was meant to manage risk, also really appealed to the gambling side of the English middle class.
How so?
It got pretty extreme. People were literally placing bets at Lloyd's on when prominent sick people would die, often based just on newspaper reports.
Seriously. That's great now. Just betting on someone dying.
It was, and it caused a huge backlash, understandably. In 1769, a group of, I think, 79 underwriters broke away because they were disgusted by it.
Okay.
They set up a new Lloyd's Coffee House in 1771, which eventually became the Lloyd's we know, and Parliament had to step in too. They passed a law in 1774 banning wagering on people's deaths, trying to clean things up.
A necessary move, sounds like. Separating real protection from just betting.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did these ideas make their way over to America?
Well, the U.S. insurance industry was pretty much built on the British model, especially early on. The very first insurance company in the colonies popped up in Charleston, South Carolina, way back in 1735. And then in 1759, the Presbyterian Synod of Philadelphia sponsored the first life insurance corporation in America. It was specifically for ministers and their families.
Interesting.
What's also interesting is that this corporation existed before the first actual life insurance policy was issued.
Huh. So the structure came before the product, almost. What does that suggest?
Yeah, it seems the initial focus was really on creating the financial vehicle for protection, even before they'd fully worked out the specific policy details.
Okay, but it sounds like things got off to a pretty slow start in America generally.
Oh, very slow. Despite those early efforts, you didn't see significant growth, really, until after 1840.
Why so late?
A big part of it was less opposition from religious groups. They'd been pretty hesitant about life insurance initially. And the document mentions that even though 26 companies offering life insurance were set up between 1787 and 1837, most of them didn't last very long.
So, a shaky beginning.
Hmm.
But some must have done okay. What made the difference for the ones that survived?
Good question. Probably things like better financial planning, maybe more effective marketing, just a better feel for the American market, perhaps. It was a tough environment.
So were there any early players that managed to stick around and build something?
Yeah, a few managed to get some traction. There was the Pennsylvania Company for Insurances on Lives and Granting Annuities, chartered in 1812, the Massachusetts Hospital Life Insurance Company in 1818, Baltimore Life, 1830, New York Life Insurance and Trust, also 1830, and the Girard Life Insurance Annuity and Trust Company of Pennsylvania from 1836.
Okay, so a handful.
Right, and some did pretty well for the time. By 1840, for example, New York Life and Trust had the most insurance in force, like over half of the total, which was maybe around $5 million across all companies then. Not huge by today's standards, but significant.
Right, laying the groundwork even if it was slow going. Now, the history also talks about big events, like fires impacting the industry.
Yeah, the big New York fire in 1835 was a huge wake-up call, just devastating losses. it really drove home the need for companies to actually have money set aside for disasters.
Made the risk very real.
Exactly. And as a direct result, Massachusetts in 1837 passed the first state law requiring insurance companies to maintain reserves, basically, dedicated funds to cover potential losses.
Okay, that makes sense.
Then the Great Chicago Fire in 1871 hit, again emphasizing the huge fire risk in cities.
Right. And did all this awareness lead to other developments?
It did. This era saw the development of reinsurance.
Reinsurance, like insurance for the insurers.
Pretty much, yeah. It's a way for insurance companies to spread their risk by insuring parts of their own policies with other companies.
So even the insurers needed insurance. Were there any hiccups getting that started? Any skepticism?
Oh, I'm sure there were. Establishing trust, figuring out standard agreements between companies, that probably took some time. But the need was clearly there after those big fires.
Okay. And the document briefly mentions other types of insurance popping up, too.
Yeah, you know, cars started appearing late 19th century, so public liability insurance became a thing. And over in Britain, the Workmen's Compensation Act of 1897 made accident insurance for employees mandatory. Big steps.
And it wasn't just the big commercial companies involved, was it? Fraternal orders played a role, too.
Oh, a huge role. Throughout the 19th century, all these societies and fraternal orders started up. They offered low-cost life and health insurance, but just for their members.
Kind of like member benefits.
Exactly. Often nonprofit, built around, you know, shared jobs or backgrounds. And many still exist today, alongside unions offering insurance. And then, of course, you got employer-sponsored group policies becoming more common, too.
So insurance was becoming available through more channels, and the source mentioned the U.S. market developed differently from Britain's. What were the key divergences?
Well, America was just different. Huge country, really diverse population, and this strong streak of wanting independence, self-reliance.
Right.
So as the U.S. grew, changed from farming to industry, the insurance business here developed its own flavor, its own challenges, distinct from the U.K. model.
Okay. Now, the mid-19th century.
Yeah.
That seems like a real turning point. Suddenly, life insurance growth really takes off in the U.S. What fueled that?
You're absolutely right. It was a massive shift. Life insurance in force jumps from maybe $600,000 in 1830 to nearly $100 million by 1850.
Wow, that's incredible growth.
It is. And the big three then, Mutual Life of New York, Mutual Benefit Life of New Jersey, and Connecticut Mutual, they held over half of that total.
Yeah.
And this boom was really driven by two main things, crucial changes in laws and the rise of mutual life insurance companies.
Okay, let's tackle the laws first. The history mentions Married Women's Acts. What were the problems women faced with life insurance before that?
This is really important. Even though women and children were often meant to benefit from policies, the legal system back then made it really hard for women to actually secure that protection themselves. Well, first, there's this concept of insurable interest. You know, you can insure your own house because you'd lose out if it burned down, right?
Right.
But the law wasn't always clear if a wife had a direct enough financial stake in her husband's life to insure it. Seems crazy now, but that was the thinking. And second, married women often couldn't legally enter into contracts on their own.
So they couldn't even sign up for a policy?
Pretty much. It excluded them from a system designed, in theory, to protect them.
So what did people do? What was the workaround, and why wasn't it ideal?
Usually, the husband would buy the policy and name his wife as the beneficiary. But the catch was that policy was legally part of his assets, his estate.
Ah, so if he had debts.
Exactly. His creditors could come after the insurance money, potentially leaving the wife and kids with nothing.
That's incredibly unfair. Okay, so thankfully, New York passed a law in 1840 that started to change things. What did it do?
Yes, this 1840 New York law, pushed by New York Life and Trust, was a game changer. Four key things, really. One, it specifically gave married women the right to insure their husband's lives directly or through a trustee if the husband consented.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it shielded that insurance money from the husband's creditors up to a certain limit, like a $300 annual premium, which could buy maybe a $10,000 policy then.
That's significant protection.
Huge. Three, if the wife died before the husband, the policy went to the kids, still protected from creditors. And four, maybe the biggest impact, the courts basically said this law established insurable interest just based on the marriage itself, not necessarily direct financial dependence.
Wow. Recognizing the inherent value in the relationship itself, that's a massive shift. And this wasn't just New York.
Nope. Maryland followed really quickly, later in 1840, with a similar law. Pennsylvania, New Jersey, too. though Jersey's 1851 law had a lower premium limit, only $100.
Okay.
And even where states didn't have specific laws yet, new insurance companies often wrote these protections right into their charters, and the courts tended to uphold them.
So a real move towards better security for women and families. Now, the other big driver you mentioned was mutuality. What exactly is a mutual life insurance company?
Right. So a mutual company is different from a stock company. In a stock company, profits go to the shareholders, the owners.
Okay.
In a mutual company, there are no stockholders. The profits generated each year are actually returned to the policyholders themselves.
Ah, so the customers own it, in a way.
Essentially, yes. The policyholders are the members and owners. Now, the idea wasn't brand new. You had mutuals in fire and marine insurance, even an early life mutual in London from 1762. But the first really successful American mutual life companies took off in the 1840s.
What caused that shift towards the mutual model here in the U.S.?
A lot of it had to do with the panic of 1837, a big financial crisis. Investor confidence just plummeted. It became really hard to raise the capital needed to start a traditional stock insurance company. Mm. Mutuals, though, didn't need much initial capital. They relied on collecting premiums from lots of policyholders to cover claims and costs. That made them way more practical and more appealing in that tough economic climate.
Makes sense. Less risky to start up.
Exactly. So you see companies like New England Mutual Life starting up first policy in 1844 and Mutual Life of New York starting in 1843. They were pioneers, and by 1849, there were at least 15 more mutuals chartered.
So relying on collective premiums rather than big upfront investments. And how did these new mutuals get customers? Did they operate differently?
Oh, completely differently. They were much more proactive, even aggressive with marketing compared to the old banks and stock companies, which tended to just wait for business to come to them.
What'd they do?
Mutuals started running ads in newspapers, publishing articles and pamphlets explaining the benefits, and crucially, they hired and sent out soliciting agents to actively sell policies. It was a whole new approach.
Actively building the market then. And what was the appeal for the public? Why was a mutual?
Well, the idea of mutuality itself was really popular. People who couldn't afford shares in a stock company could now effectively share in the success of these mutuals.
Through those return profits.
Exactly. Any surplus money left after paying claims and expenses was redistributed back to the policyholders, often as lower future premiums or dividends. So you combine that active marketing with the appeal of potentially getting money back. That really lit a fire under life insurance growth in the late 1840s.
So you've got helpful laws and this popular new business model converging. But then the source talks about regulation and stagnation after 1849. What slowed the momentum?
Right. Well, the very ease of starting these mutuals also opened the door for some, let's say, less sound or even fraudulent companies.
The downside of easy entry.
Exactly. So concerns grew about the industry's reputation. The established stock companies, probably also seeing the competition, started lobbying hard for stricter rules. This led to New York passing laws in 1849 requiring new companies to have $100,000 in capital stock. And then in 1851, an even tougher law demanding a $100,000 deposit with the state comptroller.
Wow, that sounds like a huge barrier, especially for new mutuals that relied on not needing much capital.
It was a massive hurdle. The big established stock companies and the larger New York mutuals could handle it, sure. But it effectively killed off the further spread of new mutual companies for decades.
Really?
Yeah. Plus, quite a few out-of-state companies just pulled out of New York rather than meet those requirements. So most people agree these regulations were a big reason why life insurance sales basically flatlined for almost 10 years after 1849.
So regulation aimed at stability actually caused stagnation, at least initially. Interesting tension there, but things picked up again. The Civil War era is mentioned as a period of revival.
Yes. By the late 1850s, sales started climbing again. And then during the Civil War, they absolutely soared, tripled by the end of the war, reaching a peak in total insurance in force around 1871.
What drove that wartime boom?
Several things came together. One, states like Massachusetts in 1856 and New York 1859 set up dedicated insurance departments. That boosted public confidence, felt like there was proper oversight.
Okay, more trust.
Two, Massachusetts passed a really important non-forfeiture law in 1861. This meant if you stopped paying premiums, you didn't just lose everything. Your policy converted to term life insurance for a while.
Oh, that's much.
Yeah, a big consumer protection. And they strengthened it later in 1880, adding the option of getting a cash surrender value back.
So better regulation, better consumer protection.
Yeah.
Building trust.
What about the war itself? That must have made people think about mortality.
Absolutely. It was a period of intense awareness of death. Now, interestingly, there wasn't much data on wartime death rates, and many existing policies actually had clauses voiding coverage if you joined the military.
Right.
But several big companies decided to cover war risks anyway, usually for an extra premium. Financially, it was often just break even for them. But the goodwill they got from paying claims to grieving families was enormous.
Mm, I can imagine. That, plus the general heightened awareness of mortality, really spurred interest in life insurance. And then after the war, there was an economic boom, and a lot of investment flowed into the life insurance industry, too.
So the war, paradoxically, ended up being a catalyst for growth. Now, the source also mentions tontines as a big innovation then. What on earth were tontines? Sounds exotic.
Huh. Yeah, tontines, or deferred dividend policies. Equitable Life introduced them in the U.S. in 1867. They were kind of a mix of life insurance and an investment scheme.
How do they work?
Okay, so part of your premium paid for a standard death benefit, like regular life insurance, but another part went into this special investment fund. This fund had a set end date, maybe 10 or 20 years out, and only a specific group of policyholders were in it together.
Okay, like a pool. What happened with that pool?
Here's the twist. If you died during that period, your family only got the basic death benefit, not a share of the investment fund.
Oh.
And if you let your policy lapse, stopped paying. You usually lost everything you'd put into the investment part or got very little back.
Ouch. So where did the money go?
At the end of the 10 or 20 years, all the accumulated dividends and earnings in that fund, including all the money forfeited by people who died or lapsed, was divided up only among the policyholders who were still alive and had kept their policies active the whole time.
Wow. So the survivors basically split the pot, which included money for those who dropped out or died. That sounds kind of like a lottery or a gamble.
It had a strong element of that, yes. And agents pushed them hard, often using really inflated estimates of the potential payout, playing on the idea that you would be one of the lucky survivors benefiting from others' lapses.
I bet.
It was incredibly popular. By 1905, something like two-thirds of all life insurance policies in the U.S. were these deferred dividend tontine plans.
Two-thirds. That's staggering, despite the obvious risks. But okay, this boom period didn't last forever. The late 19th century saw challenges, too.
It did. The 1870s were brutal for the life insurance industry. A severe depression hit.
Why then?
Combination of things. The market was just saturated after that crazy post-war growth, and there was a general economic downturn hitting the whole country.
Right.
A lot of those newer companies that popped up in the 60s just couldn't handle the pressure. Many failed, went out of business. And that meant huge losses for their policyholders.
How bad was it?
Bad enough that the total amount of life insurance in force in the U.S. didn't get back to its 1870 peak until 1888. Took almost two decades to recover. A real shakeout.
Oh, major correction. And during this tough time, the history mentions assessment and fraternal insurance companies becoming more prominent.
Yes. Assessment companies, sometimes called cooperative or mutual aid societies, tried a different model. Instead of fixed premiums, they'd charge members a flat fee whenever another member died, just enough to pay the death benefit.
Pay as you go, almost.
Kind of, but it was inherently unstable. You couldn't predict death rates accurately, and it was hard to keep enough members, especially as the group got older and deaths became more frequent. Most eventually collapsed or had to switch to a more traditional mutual structure.
Sounds precarious. What about the fraternal organizations?
Fraternals really boomed after the Civil War. These were voluntary groups based on shared background, ethnicity, job, whatever. They became huge providers of life insurance, especially for working class families who maybe couldn't afford or access the big commercial policies.
Were they more stable?
Initially, many also used that risky assessment model, but most quickly shifted to a proper mutual insurance structure, which was much sounder. By the turn of the century, they were massive, major competitors to the stock and mutual companies, insuring millions of people.
So they filled a really important gap in the market.
Definitely. Made insurance much more accessible.
Okay, another innovation mentioned from this era is industrial life insurance. What made that different?
Industrial life insurance was another way to reach folks who were previously left out. Companies like John Hancock, MetLife, Prudential pioneered this in the mid-1870s.
How did it work?
It targeted lower-income families. The policies were for really small amounts, maybe just $100 or $200. And instead of paying once or twice a year, you paid a tiny premium, like a few cents up to maybe 65 cents every single week.
Every week.
Yeah, often collected door-to-door by agents. They usually didn't require medical exams, which made it easier to get coverage. And you could insure the whole family, even kids.
Sounds very different.
It was. So while the number of industrial policies sold was enormous, the total dollar amount of insurance in force was smaller compared to traditional policies, but it brought basic protection to millions.
Right. Meeting people where they were financially. And it seems American companies were also starting to look abroad around this time.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Between about 1885 and 1905, the major U.S. life insurers expanded internationally really rapidly. Companies like Equitable, New York Life, Mutual Life. By 1900, they were operating all over the world.
Really? Global reach?
Absolutely. Raking in significant premium income from foreign operations, lots of insurance in force outside the U.S. by 1905. American life insurance was becoming a global business.
So, huge growth, innovation, global expansion. But this period also seems to have bred some serious problems. Which brings us to the Armstrong Committee. What exactly sparked that investigation?
Right. The Armstrong Committee investigation in 1905, it kicked off because major newspapers started publishing exposés. They were alleging crazy executive spending, big political payoffs, shady dealings, especially at Equitable Life.
Uh-oh.
The worry was, you know, was this happening at the expense of the policyholders? The New York State Insurance Department did a quick, limited investigation first and found, yeah, there was some truth to it.
So that triggered a bigger response.
Exactly. The New York legislature set up a special joint committee led by Senator Armstrong to do a deep dive into the practices of all life insurance companies operating in New York. And they brought in Charles Evans Hughes, later Chief Justice Hughes, as chief counsel to lead the charge.
Okay, a serious investigation. Yeah. What kind of abuses did they actually uncover?
Oh, it was a laundry list of bad practices. They found interlocking directorates, same people on the boards of competing companies, huge potential for conflicts of interest.
Hmm.
They found companies setting up subsidiary firms just to get around investment rules. They found management abusing proxy voting to keep control of mutual companies against policyholders' wishes.
Wow.
Plus, just outrageous company expenses, massive spending on lobbying and political donations, agents giving illegal rebates to get clients, companies actually encouraging policies to lapse so they could keep the reserves.
Yeah.
And this practice called twisting.
Twisting? What's that?
That's where agents would badmouth competitors, lie about their stability to get people to switch policies, often losing money in the process.
Mm.
And the committee really slammed the New York Insurance Department for basically letting all this happen under their noses.
It sounds like a total mess. A crisis of ethics and oversight. What happened next? What regulations came out of this?
The New York legislature acted fast and decisively. In 1907, they passed a whole raft of strict new regulations.
Like what?
They defined exactly what kinds of investments were acceptable for insurance companies, put sharp limits on lobbying and campaign spending, forced mutual companies to be more democratic by banning proxy voting abuse, mandated standardized policy forms so people could actually understand them.
That seems crucial.
Totally. They clamped down on agent misbehavior like rebating and twisting, and importantly, they outright banned those risky deferred dividend-tentine policies.
Or dividend-tentine.
Gone. And they required companies to pay out dividends to policyholders regularly and more frequently. It was a sweeping reform package.
Very comprehensive. Did these New York laws just affect companies in New York?
No, and this is key. Because New York was the center of the insurance world then, its rules had a massive national impact. They used something called the Appleton Rule.
The Appleton Rule.
Yeah. It basically said, if you want to do business in New York, which every major company did, you have to follow New York's insurance laws in all your operations, everywhere, not just in New York.
Wow. So New York was effectively setting the standard for the whole country.
Pretty much. The Massachusetts Insurance Commissioner at the time called it national supervision by New York. The Appleton Rule was formally written into law later in 1939, and it shaped U.S. insurance regulation for decades.
A huge turning point then, bringing in oversight, restoring trust. And did the industry keep growing in the early 20th century after all this upheaval?
Actually, yes. Maybe surprisingly, the Armstrong investigation and the new laws seemed to reassure the public about the basic safety of life insurance.
Interesting.
So you saw a new wave of company formations between 1905 and 1914. Total life insurance in force kept climbing rapidly, and the market share of those fraternal and assessment societies started to shrink as the commercial companies grew stronger and, well, cleaner.
And there's another big innovation around that, too, group insurance.
Yes, group life insurance was huge for accessibility. In 1911, Equitable wrote a landmark policy covering all the employees at the Pantasote Leather Company. The key was, No individual applications, no medical exams needed for each person.
Ah, covering the whole group.
Exactly. It was a big shift. Equitable even set up a dedicated group department the next year. By 1919, lots of companies were writing group policies, and the amount of insurance under group plans was growing fast.
Another way to bring insurance to more people. Through their jobs. Mm-hmm. And then World War I happened. How did that impact things?
World War I had a really unique effect. In 1917, the U.S. government started its own insurance program called War Risk Insurance.
For soldiers.
For everyone on active duty. It provided a standard $4,500 life insurance policy. The government also offered really cheap term life and disability insurance to service members. No medical exam required.
Was it popular?
Incredibly popular. By 1919, there was over $40 billion with a B of this war risk insurance in force. Just astronomical. Now, demand for those government term policies dropped off after the war as soldiers came home and often bought whole life policies from private companies instead. But the experience of having life insurance during the war definitely boosted overall interest. Life insurance sales absolutely surged after World War I, hitting another peak in 1930.
So tracing this all the way from, you know, ancient Chinese merchants splitting cargo to avoid pirates, all the way up to a highly regulated, massive industry in the 20th century with group plans and government programs, it's really been quite a ride.
It truly has. You see the journey from these informal mutual aid ideas to complex legal contracts, the rise of community support networks like guilds and fraternals, the huge impact of laws and regulations shaping how the industry behaves, and this constant innovation trying to meet changing needs and risks.
So when you boil it all down, what does this incredibly long history tell us about why life insurance exists, why we need it?
I think fundamentally, it just highlights this deep, persistent human need for security, for some way to protect against life's uncertainties. Whether it was those ancient traders worried about storms and pirates or modern families wanting to make sure loved ones are okay financially, that core desire to protect, to provide stability when loss happens, that's the constant thread running through millennia.
Looking back at that whole sweep of history, thousands of years, it really makes you wonder, doesn't it? With all the rapid changes happening now, technology, society shifting so fast, how do you think life insurance itself, the very concept and how it's delivered, might keep changing in the decades ahead?
That's the big question, isn't it?
And, you know, thinking about its roots in communal support and risk sharing, how much of that original spirit do you think still exists in today's, let's face it, often very complex financial products? Definitely something to chew on.